You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk with former State Corrections Secretary Ed Wall about his new book, Unethical, Life in Scott Walker's Cabinet and the Dirty Side of Politics. First, President Trump's pick for Supreme Court Justice is meeting with individual senators ahead of his confirmation hearing next month. Yesterday, he sat down with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. This morning on Fox News, Johnson called Kavanaugh a really nice guy and a person of integrity, and that there's no question he should be confirmed.
I don't see how anybody could oppose his nomination. We consider his incredible judicial record. Democrats have a dozen years of experience. I don't know, are they going to be looking for his fourth grade essays? They have more than enough information to make a decision. This should be 100-0 in terms of the vote.
Democrats have been requesting specific documents from the National Archives on Kavanaugh's time as White House staff secretary during the George W. Bush years. But an archives spokesperson says those kinds of requests can only come from committee chairs, and Republicans aren't too keen on asking for them. Last weekend, the Judiciary Committee released some 80,000 pages of documents from Kavanaugh's time as a White House lawyer. So far, more than 103,000 pages of material have been made public. So what do they tell us about Kavanaugh's White House tenure? Jordan Carney is the Senate reporter for The Hill. Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
As we said, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin seemed fairly impressed with Kavanaugh. What kind of reaction has he been getting from other senators with whom he's met?
Yeah, I would say the reaction that we've seen is pretty closely so far, breaking down along partisan lines. So far, most of the Republicans have met with him. Only Senator Susan Collins from Maine and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska are holding out so far. All the Republican reaction has been, you know, very positive, you know, expecting to support him, think he'll be confirmed. So far, most of the Democratic caucus has not actually sat down with him. So far, we've had three. We've had Joe Donnelly from Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. They aren't saying, you know, whether or not they're going to support him. They are saying they had, you know, productive meetings. They, you know, they had wide-ranging discussions, but not a lot of insight there into how they actually think about Kavanaugh.
And why would those three Democrats in particular be willing to meet with him when their colleagues have not?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously those are the three Democrats that supported President Trump's first Supreme Court nominee last year, Neil Gorsuch. They're viewed as the three Democrats most likely to vote yes this time, and importantly, there are three Democrats running for re-elections in states that were won pretty easily by Trump in 2016.
And as you said, Senator Murkowski from Alaska, Senator Collins from Maine, they are Republicans who have not yet met with him. They are also Republicans that have been seen as possibly able to be swayed to vote against him. They have sided with Democrats on other issues. Is this meaningful that they haven't met with him yet?
I mean, when you talk to them, they really just say, you know, there's a ton of paperwork. He's got 12 years on the court. We really want to take our time and go through with this before, you know, we meet with him. Senator Murkowski told some reporters earlier that she expects to meet with him next week. You know, Senator Collins has said she expects to meet with him in the later part of this month. So, I mean, I think it's just they're trying to do their due diligence before they meet with him.
Senator Johnson said there's no way anybody should vote against Brett Kavanaugh, but Wisconsin's other senator, Democrat Tammy Baldwin, said Americans don't want the Supreme Court to, quote, advance a political agenda to overturn the law of the land on health care for people with pre-existing conditions and women's reproductive health, and then she said on other matters as well. Do we have an idea of how much support there is right now in general for Kavanaugh's confirmation?
Well, because the Senate changed the rules last year, he's only going to need a simple majority support. So let's say that all the Republicans decide to vote for him, he can automatically get confirmed. He wouldn't need Democrats in that instance. Most of the Democratic caucus is expected to be a no vote. There are some, you know, that are still riding on the fence saying they want to wait until the hearing, but they are expected to be no. So when you talk to, you know, Republican leadership, they put, you know, maybe the number of yes votes, they can get around 54, which would be the three Democrats that voted for Gorsuch last year, and then all the Republicans.
Jordan Carney is the Senate reporter for The Hill. We're talking with her about where we're at in the vetting process of Brett Kavanaugh, who has been nominated to fill the open seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley of Iowa has scheduled Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing for September 4th and said it would last for 3 or 4 days. What actually happens in those confirmation hearings, Jordan?
Yeah, so this is kind of their first chance to talk to Kavanaugh publicly and sort of really push him in front of the cameras on these issues that they feel important. Democrats will probably ask about health care and abortion rights and executive authority and what that might mean for the Mueller investigation. It's Kavanaugh's first chance to really kind of introduce himself to the American people, or at least the American people that are going to be watching his confirmation hearing. But it is very choreographed, I would say. Republicans have a certain set of questions. Democrats have, you know, a different set of questions, and they're going to try to push Kavanaugh to explain his thinking on some of the legal issues that they feel are really central to this vote.
And how much are the confirmation hearings a chance for senators to actually speak more to their constituents? I mean, they have the opportunity to get questions answered by Kavanaugh or through other means. Is this more of a way for them to telegraph to their constituents what issues that they're championing?
Yeah, they're really going to be asking questions about the issues that they, I mean, that their constituents care about and that they care about. Like I mentioned, Democrats will really be trying to kind of lay out their message to him on things like health care and abortion and executive authority, but also trying to get him to not necessarily slip up, but to be a little more candid on what he thinks about those issues.
And with that confirmation hearing set for September 4th and expected to take a few days, what does that then mean for the timeline of when the full Senate vote might happen?
Yeah, so there was some speculation over like the past month that maybe the vote would get pushed into later into October just because of the volume of documents that needed to be produced and all the meetings. But once they announced that the hearing would start on September 4th, you had John Cornyn, who's the number two Republican up here, say this actually puts them on track to have a full Senate vote before October 1st, so have him on the bench if he's confirmed by the time the Supreme Court starts its next term.
Well, that's interesting because Senator Grassley has also requested documents from Kavanaugh's time as a White House lawyer. The National Archives say that could total more than 900,000 pages and that they would likely not be able to fulfill that request until late October. That would put that well after that. Is that a problem?
So that's part of what is infuriating Democrats right now, is that they feel like they're not going to have, you know, an adequate amount of time to review documents. The National Archives, as you mentioned, is still going to be handing over documents, even past the confirmation hearing and, you know, potentially past a vote. Republicans sort of brushed all that aside and say it's fine because we have the second document production happening from a lawyer for President George W. Bush who's going through the same set of documents and handing them over to us sort of at a faster rate. So we'll get these documents, we'll just get them from a different source.
One of the issues that I've seen raised is that Brett Kavanaugh may be a nominee who would see the scope of presidential authority and what the president can do as wider and interpreted more loosely than some other people who might be qualified for this position. Is that something that is likely to be brought up in the confirmation hearing?
I would be surprised if that's not one of the first things that are brought up once Democrats start asking their questions in this confirmation hearing, just because they're very concerned about that, particularly in the way that Brett Kavanaugh might think a president can interpret laws. They think it might have implications for the Robert Mueller investigation. And going back to Kavanaugh's work, you know, during the Clinton administration on Ken Starr's investigation and just sort of parsing through what he, sort of where he thinks the bounds presidential power are.
Where are those concerns coming from? What do people for whom that's an issue point to as a red flag in Kavanaugh's background?
Yeah, there have been some law review articles that Kavanaugh wrote post-Clinton that basically said, you know, I don't think it's helpful for a president to be indicted. I understand that, you know, the American people kind of want the president to be normal, but I think we should give them some reprieve from normalcy of American life. There was some work that he did as part of Ken Starr's investigation saying, I don't think we're going to indict the president. He should be indicted while he's still in office. the Democrats are really digging into his previous writings and his previous speeches and trying to figure out where exactly he, what his thinking is now on those issues.
So we're about 3 weeks out from the confirmation hearing. Brett Kavanaugh will be continuing these meetings with senators, the rest of the Republicans, possibly some Democrats. Jordan, what are you going to be watching for in these next few weeks as regards to how smoothly this nomination might go?
Yeah, so, I mean, some of the big outstanding meetings, obviously, are going to be Murkowski and Collins and, you know, hearing what they say coming out of those meetings. And, you know, do they have any concerns, particularly on the abortion issue, which is important to both of them? Senator Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, is going to be meeting with Kavanaugh next week. And then there's sort of this lingering fight over the documents. Democrats said today that if they can't get the National Archives to respond to their Freedom of Information Act request for Kavanaugh's documents, including all of his White House documents, that they are going to sue for those documents. So that would sort of elevate the fight to a new level.
Well, Jordan, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Jordan Carney is a Senate reporter for The Hill. We talked with her about the latest on the vetting process of President Trump's nominee for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. In a new tell-all book, former State Corrections Secretary Ed Wahl is taking Governor Scott Walker and Attorney General Brad Schimmel to task, especially over their handling of inmate abuse at Wisconsin's youth prisons. He says because of political reasons, the two refused to get more involved. Wahl resigned in 2016 as the federal government began its investigation into abuse at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. He later took a job with the Department of Justice. After being fired by Schimmel a short time later, he said he came close to killing himself. Ed Wahl's book is titled Unethical, Life in Scott Walker's Cabinet and the Dirty Side of Politics. Secretary Wahl, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Judith. Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the beginning and work our way forward. You were the administrator of the Division of Criminal Investigation at the Department of Justice when Scott Walker was elected governor in 2010. Tell us what your first impressions of the governor-elect were.
You know, I had never heard of him, really, aside from seeing articles here and there in the paper when he was Milwaukee County Executive. And I made a large effort to stay away from politics. I became more aware of Scott Walker when District Attorney John Chisholm came to us to brief us on the John Doe investigation that he was doing, and he wanted the Department of Justice to take over the investigation into candidate Scott Walker at the time. And Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen and the Deputy Attorney General at the time, Ray Tafora, and I discussed it, and ultimately the Attorney General made the decision that he would not take the investigation of the John Doe cases, primarily just for political reasons. It was just not something that they wanted to undertake, and they encouraged and preferred to the federal system. When I met Walker during the transition, I liked him. I mean, he was a very, very nice guy, you know, and when I watched his ads on TV, I thought, well, maybe this guy's something different. You know, he brings his lunch to work in a paper bag, and, you know, he drives an old car, which I found out he did. And I said, well, you know, maybe he's just not one of those power-hungry politicians who's out to just feather their own nest. Unfortunately, I found out that I was wrong, but that was my first impression.
Well, shortly after he took office, Governor Walker introduced Act 10, and you write in your book that it wasn't so much the scope of the bill that concerned you, but the carve-outs from it. Explain that for us.
Well, I understood, or at least I heard what the reasoning was behind the Act 10, and I saw for what it was. I mean, the disguise of the budget bill was that he wanted to eliminate public sector bargaining, and that's exactly what he did. So I understood what the idea was. The thing that bothered me was the carve-outs, and it affected me and my agency personally. So he exempted law enforcement and emergency services under the auspices that, you know, that public safety had to be protected. And I think that was probably done because he was pretty cognizant of the fact there were going to be some protests, and he didn't want to have to deal with the police and being involved in that. But he then went a little bit further, and he exempted the state patrol so that they were able to bargain for their pay and for their benefits and their working conditions. And yet he did not include the rest of state law enforcement. So that was my agents in the Division of Criminal Investigation, the Capitol Police, the University Police, the Department of Natural Resources were all exempted from the carve-out which gave me great pause. And I said, well, you know, why would this be? And, I mean, the answer was obvious. It was because the head of the State Patrol was the son of two senators who were working to get his Act 10, or were going to be working to get the Act 10 things through. And they also provide his security detail, and they drive him everywhere. So it just seemed to be a pretty self-serving reason to exempt one state agency, law enforcement agency, and not the rest.
So you had some hesitations and concerns, and then about a year later in 2012, Gary Hamblin stepped down as Corrections Secretary, and Governor Walker asked you to take over the department. What were you thinking when you considered whether or not to take that job?
Well, actually, they came to me at the transition and talked to me then about going, and I declined it because I was on probation as the administrator of the Division of Criminal Investigation, which is a civil service sworn law enforcement position that is not supposed to be serving at the will of the Attorney General. And if I left while I was on probation, I would not have had restoration to my job. So you had mentioned before I went back to justice to take another job. Actually, the only reason I left was because the law guaranteed me that I would be able to go back to my position. And that's what caused me to get into bumping heads with Schimmel, with me trying to go back.
We're talking with Ed Wall right now. He's former Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Corrections, and he's the author of the new book, Unethical: Life in Scott Walker's Cabinet and the Dirty Side of Politics. And so we know from your book and from other sources that before that, before you took over, a Racine County judge had warned Governor Walker's office of safety issues at Lincoln Hills, the youth prison for boys. Did that come up in your meeting with him when he was asking you to take over the DOC?
Never. And the first time I saw that letter was when it was published in the paper. When I had spoken with the governor about taking the position, they had talked to me about the fact that we had a rapidly increasing number of geriatric inmates that were probably going to need my attention. But they never mentioned the letter from the judge, because had they, I would have dove right into it. That's just the way that I operate. And when I saw that letter, and then I saw the governor basically saying that, you know, I didn't know anything about it, the letter in the paper had handwritten on the top, Alex I, underlined with policy, and that I knew who that was. It's Alex Ignatowski, who is his closest aide, and is also the husband of the governor's legal chief, Katie Ignatowski. So to say that the governor wasn't aware of it, or it was handled by a policy person, I knew after having been in the administration that was absolutely ridiculous. There's no way that his legal chief or one of his closest advisors wouldn't have gone to him and said, this is pretty big, you need to be aware of this.
Well, and then when Attorney General Brad Schimmel took office in 2014, you say that you gave him a personal briefing on Lincoln Hills. What was his response?
He came over when Brad first came to meet with me, came to my office, seemed like a very nice guy. I had met him. We would be co-chairing the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council together. That's why we wanted to get together to talk. I briefed him extensively, and I told him, here's what we have going on. These are the allegations that are being made. Here's what we've done so far. I requested the investigation into it because I knew it needed to be handled by an outside agency. And I also knew that the implications could be statewide, because it could be involving kids that were harmed and then released, and they could be living anywhere in the state. And the only state agency that has statewide criminal jurisdiction is the Division of Criminal Investigation, my old agency. So I requested the investigation, and I asked him to please make sure that it was a priority for them, because it left a lot of exposure for the governor and for our agency, and not to mention the fact we had allegations that kids were being harmed by state employees, and there shouldn't be anything more important than that.
In 2015, you visited Lincoln Hills for an unannounced tour. What did you find when you did that?
Oh, I made dozens and dozens and dozens of unannounced tours at Lincoln Hills. I was there just about every day for months. But in August, I had received a call from the sheriff, who had his sergeant detectives had spoken to somebody at the institution at Lincoln Hills, and they said that, you know, the kids are really getting out of control, and he kind of attributed to the fact that the Department of Justice was just dragging their feet in the investigation. They had one agent working part-time on this investigation for 10 months, and that was the part that was really infuriating us at the Department of Corrections, is why would you not devote resources to this? And when I went up to visit, some of the kids were yelling, I'm being tortured, I'm being injured, but they were laughing and fooling around. And when I went into the library, there's a group of guys there, and they all knew who I was, because I was there fairly frequently. And They said, we're being beaten. We're being tortured. And I walked right over, and I stood there with them, and they got in a circle around me, and I said, so tell me. I said, what happened? And I talked to each one of them. I said, tell me what happened to you. Well, nothing happened to me. It was somebody that I knew, or I heard about a guy in another cottage. And come to find out, none of the kids had been, you know, they were basically talking from what they'd heard from other people. And I told them, and I told the librarian, I said, I want these kids to be able to contact me anytime. And you make sure that when they come to you, they can give you the information and it gets to me. And he understood. I never heard from any of them. But it certainly made me realize that the impact that the way the Department of Justice was running the investigation was severely impacting the climate in the institution, because the kids knew that there were investigators there, you know, here and there, and they were aware that somebody was doing an investigation about people being injured or hurt, and it was just ratcheting up the tension that was in the institution between the officers and with the youth. So it was an uncomfortable situation.
Secretary Wall, as you have published this book and have been talking about it, the Walker administration has said that actually the fault lies with you, that this fell squarely under your jurisdiction. Briefly, how would you respond to that?
Well, that's absolutely nonsense. And I think it was actually Brad Schimmel who said that. And Brad Schimmel has got a lot to be worried about and to hide from, because his agency just basically ignored Lincoln Hills until somebody got hurt. And that's the fact of the matter. He's dodged releasing any kind of documents. He's made completely false accusations in the press. He points to the fact that he terminated me because he says that I encouraged a state employee to destroy a public record, when he knows, in fact, that the public record was a draft of my appeal document. It wasn't like these were the Nixon tapes. This was my appeal document that only pertained to me.
And we'll have to leave it there. Ed Wall, thank you so much for joining us. Ed Wall is a former secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. We talked with him about his new book, Unethical, Life in Scott Walker's Cabinet and the Dirty Side of Politics. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. More than 300 newspapers published editorials today to voice their support for a free press. The move was coordinated by the Boston Globe after President Trump heightened his rhetoric towards the media, calling them the, quote, enemy of the people, and saying they were, quote, dangerous and sick. Papers participated across the country and some right here in Wisconsin. An editorial today from the Chippewa Herald starts by saying, it's the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it governs our rights as citizens, and it's straightforward. The Rivertown Editorial Board in New Richmond said, the power of the Fourth Estate and representative government only exists when a free people knows what their elected government has done. And at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the editorial board pointed to the paper's reporting on attempts to limit Wisconsin's open records law, saying it was a vivid example of why our democracy requires a watchdog to keep an eye on the powerful. With us now to talk about this and President Trump's relationship with the media is Courtney Radge, Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
The Boston Globe put out this call recently to publish editorials supporting the free press. What kind of response did they get, and what were they expecting?
Well, I think that we saw the response from President Trump on Twitter. It was pretty interesting to see a tweet accusing the press of colluding or of collusion for free press. I thought that was an interesting way to put it. I think what this initiative was an effort, you know, to show solidarity among journalists, because we know that, you know, an individual journalist may not be powerfully, but, you know, perhaps the media could have an impact by speaking with a single voice on a critical issue like press freedom, and perhaps compel the president to listen. I think he heard, but I don't know if he really got the message.
Were there members of the media who disagreed with this move, who thought that this was not the right approach?
My understanding is that there were some media outlets that didn't go ahead and participate in this, which is absolutely their choice. You know, I think it was a call. It wasn't certainly a mandate. I think the Wall Street Journal and San Francisco Chronicle, from what I read, decided not to participate, which is absolutely their right. What we did at the Committee to Protect Journalists is we did put something on our front page, an editorial statement, and we also made sure to provide editorial writers and editors with information from our U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, which is an initiative of 30 organizations around the United States to systematically track press freedom and threats against journalists, as well as data from our systematic tracking of journalists who are killed, imprisoned, and attacked around the world.
Now, this is not really new, this opposition to the media, to what he terms fake news, was part of then-candidate Trump's platform and rhetoric, and now President Trump's approach. Why now? Why did the Boston Globe feel like this was the time that they needed to kind of rally the troops?
You know, I think that's a great question for the Boston Globe. I know that there has been ongoing rhetoric from President Trump. There have been, you know, political rallies where he has singled out individual reporters and media organizations. And, you know, as the Committee to Protect Journalists, we're concerned about that because, you know, the vilification of individual journalists and media can make them less safe. In terms of why the Boston Globe chose today, I think you'd have to ask them that specific question.
Now, some supporters of President Trump have said that this just shows and proves that the media really is the opposition party. Is there a danger, do you think, in playing into that idea?
I think that there is a danger in equating journalism with being the enemy of the people or with opposition. The fact is that journalists are working on behalf of the public. They are the ones who are uncovering corruption in local politics, who are, you know, revealing, sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, you know, what's happening in Flint, Michigan with the water there. So, you know, it doesn't really make sense to me about looking at the media as the opposition. I think that, you know, we have to understand that journalists play a critical role in our democratic governance system. They are an independent check on power. They ensure a level of transparency that many times the government is not forthcoming with information. And so it's kind of sad to see this oppositional frame, especially when we're seeing that a record number of journalists were killed this year in the United States.
Let's talk about that for a moment. How many journalists were killed last year, and what were some of the situations that involved those deaths?
Yeah, so this year we actually saw a record number of journalists killed in the U.S. There were 4 journalists as well as a media worker killed in the Capital Gazette shooting in Maryland, right up the street from where I am. And a blogger was gunned down in Chicago under very mysterious circumstances. So that makes the number of killings in the United States, it means that we are now the third deadliest country in 2018 for journalists, right behind Afghanistan and Syria.
So two places that have open ongoing conflicts, and then us.
Right. And that's pretty unusual. You know, we don't typically see journalists being killed in the United States in relation to their work. There were 2 journalists killed, as you'll recall, on air a couple of years ago. But, you know, the murder and killing of journalists in the United States, thankfully, is pretty rare.
There are reports of some American journalists using security guards when they are covering Trump rallies. Does that concern you, that especially given the statistics that you just gave, that some reporters are feeling the need to take those steps here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it is definitely concerning. And in our reporting, we have reported on how journalists who are covering white nationalism and the far right, it's quite a dangerous beat. We've documented threats both online and offline to reporters who cover that movement. We've also documented how journalists of color face a unique set of threats when they're covering protests. So we know, you know, it's a volatile time for the press, and it's concerning when journalists feel that they need to have security guards. On the other hand, we also think that, you know, we want journalists to be prepared and to understand their threats, and so it's, you know, ultimately, hopefully, a good thing if it's keeping them safer.
We're talking with Courtney Radd. She's Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And we're talking about the coordinated editorials today, more than 300 newspapers printing editorials in support of a free press. And the United States has, for a long time, Courtney, been an advocate of press freedom around the world. How would you gauge this rhetoric and it being a message that is being repeated by supporters of the president that the media is the enemy of the people? How is that rippling around the globe?
We are seeing a significant impact around the globe because typically the United States has been a leader in press freedom. And so instead of using the platform that the United States and the president has to promote press freedom, to support First Amendment values around the world, we're seeing that the rhetoric around fake news is having a horrific influence around the world in countries from, you know, China and Iran and Russia, which frankly do not need an excuse to crack down on the press because they are some of the worst places to be a journalist. But they're happy to have the excuse of pointing to the rhetoric from, you know, emanating from President Trump and other officials. And we're seeing it in countries as varied as Poland and Hungary and Malaysia, where there are really disturbing developments in terms of restrictions of press freedom. So this, you know, effort to combat fake news is actually being used as an excuse to clamp down on investigative reporting, on independent reporting, on critical reporting. And we have evidence of this in our data because we systematically track the imprisonment of journalists. And in our 2016 census, it showed that 9 journalists were imprisoned in 2 countries around the world on false news charges. And then in 2017, this number went up to historic levels to 21 journalists in 6 countries. And we're seeing that around the world, leaders are interested in adopting fake news legislation to rein in the press.
And have you also seen those world leaders who have been hostile to the press actually using the words of President Trump to make their own cases?
Oh, we have. Yes, I have a running document where I actually keep track of this because it's so disturbing. We saw in Myanmar, for example, the use of the term fake news to dismiss reports of what the United Nations has called a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. We saw this in China, where the official news agency pointed to restrictions on access and to the enemies of the people and fake news rhetoric to say, see, we've been telling you this for years and glad to see now that the U.S. agrees with us. Literally around the world, we are seeing that this rhetoric really resonates and has been used as justification for a wide range of restrictions on the press.
We're talking with Courtney Radd right now. She's Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And we're talking about President Trump's attacks on the media and how and if journalists should respond. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the hundreds of papers that published editorials supporting a free press today? Do you think that that was an appropriate response from the media, or do you think it was a bad move? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation about the media and President Trump with Courtney Radd, Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists. We want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, should the media do when the president calls them the enemy of the people? What do you think about the president's rhetoric about the press? Do you support your local newspaper? What about journalism as a whole? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. And Aaron in Sturgeon Bay is up. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I want to, first of all, say that I am all for a free press. I think a free press is very important. However, with the advent of Project Mockingbird starting back in the 60s, the CIA gives talking points at 4 a.m. to all the major news networks. And this is not the first coordinated attack against the president. I would also like to point out the coordinated attack against QAnon, QAnon.app, who is giving very high, excellent intel to the American people to prepare them for what's coming. And what's coming is, and also journalists, I've seen journalists on television call for the assassination of President Trump, and I think that is horrible. But they're also engaged in these pedophile network and Satanism. So we're going to see a lot of things come out very shortly.
And thanks for that call, Aaron. So Aaron sees this as a coordinated attack on President Trump. Courtney, how would you respond?
I don't think that this is about attacking any individual. I think it is about standing up for a fundamental principle of American democracy that is enshrined in our First Amendment, as well as for international human rights values, which are enshrined in Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I used to work in a newspaper, never got any calls about what to publish. I think that journalists would take offense to that. But I think the key to focus on is this is not about attacking a president. This is about standing up for a fundamental human right and a fundamental American principle.
Courtney, American presidents have had historically tense relationships with the press, at least at various points in the presidencies. How would you compare President Trump's record to past presidents of maybe the last century?
Well, you know, President Obama had some major issues with the press. So President Obama used the Espionage Act more than all other administrations combined in his effort to crack down on leakers and whistleblowers. And that had a very detrimental impact on the press. One of my colleagues from the New York Times, James Risen, you know, faced a subpoena to turn over his confidential sources. We also saw Obama preside over a mass surveillance program with significant implications, negative implications for journalists and the ability of them to do their work and protect their sources. You know, every administration has a challenging relationship with the press. And I think what I've seen over my career as a journalist and as a press freedom advocate is that each successive presidency has sought to control information and control access and control the message. And of course, that can become more difficult with social media and with the internet, et cetera. So a lot of what we're seeing in terms of trends here and in terms of what's happening on the ground with journalism are things that happened prior to this administration. But what we're seeing is a convergence of trends, including, you know, the economic constriction of the media in terms of, you know, restrictions on access. So, but what's different here is the incendiary rhetoric that is aimed at individual journalists and at media outlets, and the online harassment, and then, of course, the lack of standing up for this principle globally and therefore withdrawing from world leadership.
Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I was listening, and I just wanted to call in and make the comment that it seems as though you'll hear these debates about Trump in the media and how he is creating this negative feeling about the media. And in my mind, that has been there for some time. He may have been a lightning rod. He may have drawn a lot of eyes towards that. But for a lot of us, we have been distrusting the media for a long time. In fact, it's kind of bothersome that Trump does get all the credit, because it's bigger than him. And there is a level of biasness. I was just telling your screener that I moved back to Wisconsin from Chicago after about 12 years. And one of my favorite things is Wisconsin Public Radio. It's just an awesome public radio. It's when you move outside of the state, you quickly realize just how great Wisconsin Public Radio is, you know, with Mueller and all the other shows that you have. The thing of it is, though, is that I do run conservative, and I am very conscious to the level of biasness that you hear in Wisconsin Public Radio. It's very thick. And in my mind, I feel as though Wisconsin Public Radio should be holding the lantern, or be holding the torch for unbiasedness. That there should almost be they should set the standard, and it's not true. It's not true at all. It's a very biased way of looking at things. And for someone who watched the debates and would see how it was being reported, it was almost as though with the last presidential election, it was like somebody was watching a completely different debate than I was.
And Chris, I'm going to need to stop you there just so we have time. Courtney, so there is a perception that people see the same thing and the media might report it one way and their perception was completely different.
Well, so I think the caller actually made two great points that highlight some important trends. One is the decline in trust in the media is not new. Absolutely. We did the first ever press freedom mission, basically an international group of press freedom organizations, fact-finding mission for the first time in the United States. We went to Missouri, Texas, and Washington, D.C. in order to talk to journalists, understand the challenges that they're facing. And we heard that across the board, that this trust issue is not new. So completely agree on that. And this issue of kind of the differentiation between local media and the media, I think that's something we also hear, that in general, people trust their local media, they know them, but that the national media or kind of the media as an entity is less trusted. But of course, with the challenges facing local news organizations and the decline in the number of reporters who are able to cover local communities, that has an impact on trust as well.
Let's take a quick call from Rich in Fall River. Hi, Rich. Rich?
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I am kind of agreeing with a lot of the other callers. I think there is a big distrust in the media. I think it's at like 70% of the people that distrust the media at this point. And I think it's not an attack on media itself. We're all for free press. It's attack on truly real fake news, misreported, misrepresented, biased news, and that is an enemy to the people. I think the people should be getting true factual news that is unbiased in any means, completely unbiased.
And we're running short on time, Rich. I want Courtney to have a chance to respond to that. So, Courtney, what responsibility do journalists have to be transparent about how they're doing their job and why they should be trusted?
I think that's a great question, and I think we've seen a lot of initiatives by news organizations to open up the news gathering process, open up how journalism is done so that the public can have a better understanding. But it's interesting because having worked as a journalist in the Middle East and also looking at having lived in Europe where you have a very partisan press, there are various different types of systems, and I think it's also incumbent upon viewers and readers to understand the perspective that the media is offering. And, it's fair enough to say that the media, have various different perspectives. But I think the key is journalists should not be put at risk, and that when you have the president targeting individual reporters and media organizations, that is not something that should be acceptable. And we see that there is an impact, around the world and in our own community.
And Courtney, we'll leave it there. That was Courtney Radge, Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was talking with us about President Trump and the media as hundreds of newspapers came out today with editorials supporting a free press. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a look at the college-aged conservatives, how they feel about President Trump, and whether that generation differs from their parents. And a WPR staffer joins us from vacation to give us an on-the-ground report from an iconic tourist site that celebrates a big anniversary.